What happened in South America? Why did Vice President Nixon receive the shocking treatment he got in Peru, in Venezuela, in other parts of the continent that we have assumed were friendly? Was this basic anti-American feeling, or was it all communist-inspired and directed? And what do we do about it?
These are questions everyone is asking. In an attempt to find some answers, CBS Radio presents a special edition of Radio Beat, subject Latin America. Joining in this discussion from New York and Washington will be Gallo Plaza, the former president of Ecuador, Adolph A. Burley, Jr., former assistant secretary of state, Serafino Romualdi, inter-American representative of the AFL-CIO, Robert Alexander, associate professor of economics at Rutgers University and author of the recent book Communism in Latin America, Miss Frances Grant, secretary general of the Inter-American Association for Democracy and Freedom, and Wells Church of CBS News. Now here is our moderator, CBS News correspondent, Stuart Novins.
Vice President Nixon is back in Washington. He and Mrs. Nixon have had a grueling personal experience. It's not pleasant, to say the least, when what starts out as a goodwill trip ends in booing, stone-throwing, and a situation dangerous enough to cause the White House to alert Marines and paratroopers. It's fair to say, I think, that this also was an unpleasant experience for most Americans. The realization that we are not liked is always shocking, but sober second thoughts follow the initial impact. Is it that we are not liked by large segments of South Americans, or is it simply that the communists don't like us? Does it matter whether we're liked or not? Do we need to re-examine our national policies relating to South America? Is there a real communist threat there? These are some of the questions, and the comments of our guest tonight will, I'm sure, provoke more questions. We hope they will also provoke some answers. The place to start, I suppose, is with what happened. CBS News correspondent Wells Church was traveling with Mr. Nixon. He's standing by in our Washington studios now. Church, I know you've hardly had a chance to catch your breath down there, but I wonder if you can give us a rundown of the different kinds of reactions that came in different countries that the vice president visited.
In terms of communist complaints, of course. At Montevideo, Uruguay, the communist complaints were almost drowned out in the cheers for American cooperation. At Buenos Aires, Argentina, the excitement over the inauguration of Dr. Arturo Frondizi and the noise of the Peronistas, again, pretty much drowned out the anti-Americanism of that part of South America. In Asunción, Paraguay, the government drowns out communist bleats of pain with jail sentences and police clubs. In La Paz, Bolivia, Vice President Nixon got his warmest greeting to that date. No communism that I could see apparent. In Lima, Peru, the apple cart tipped. And in Quito, they kept it tipped. And in Bogota, they upset it completely. Caracas, you all know about, the most disgraceful performance you can imagine. Indignities heaped upon the Vice President of the United States with virtually no Venezuelan police protection. Just United States Secret Service men to keep Mr. Nixon from being physically beaten. Well, what's the answer? Well, Mr. Novins, it will have to be found. That's for sure.
Well, we'll see if we can find some clues to that answer from our panel, both here in New York and in Washington. The former president of Ecuador, Mr. Gallo Plaza, is sitting here in New York with me now. Mr. Plaza, what's your reaction to all this?
Well, I must start out by saying that we in Latin America, the great majority of Latin Americans, consider the disgraceful attitude of a few people, a minority, I would say, in Peru and in Venezuela, acting in a very un-Latin American way, was quite disgraceful, and we are very sorry for what happened. I would say that it's a real mistake to try and write off the unfortunate incident as communistic inspired exclusively. I believe that the reasons are much deeper than that. There are deep-rooted problems of an economic nature throughout Latin America, and many people in Latin America believe that U.S. policy in Latin America has been inadequate to meet those growing problems, of which I'll have a chance of speaking more in detail later on.
Thank you, sir. Mr. A.A. Burley was Assistant Secretary of State for 6 years, during which time he dealt mostly with Latin American affairs. He was also ambassador to Brazil for 2 years. Mr. Burley, what's your view?
I'm in agreement with former President Gallup Plaza. I think that while these demonstrations were in most cases triggered by communists, the communist influence is by no means the entire situation. It is clear, I think, that unless there had been acquiescence in it by greater groups, the relatively small demonstrations wouldn't have been anything more than the kind of thing we're quite familiar with here. I do feel, likewise, that the American policy has been inadequate, and that inadequacy carried on over a period of years, and here my grouse is bipartisan, has finally produced a set of feelings which policy in the future must take account of and must deal with. We'll probably get at that later in this broadcast.
I sincerely hope we will, Mr. Burley. The AFL-CIO has a very active international office, and its representative for South American affairs is Serafino Rimualdi. Mr. Rimualdi, you're down there in Washington, too. You were part of the Nixon company for part of this trip, weren't you?
Yes, I was with him in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
I wonder if we could have the benefit of your views, as you saw it.
Well, I would say first that I agree with the previous speaker, my distinguished friends, Burley and Gallo Plaza, that the demonstrations were chiefly organized and directed by the communists. However, they took advantage of grievances against the American policy which accumulated in the last 10 years. But as an inter-American representative of the FOL-CIO, I would like this opportunity to state that organized labor did not take part in any of the demonstrations. On the contrary, the conversation that Vice President Nixon had in practically every country with groups of labor leaders were cordial, dignified, and fruitful. The demonstration in honor of Nixon, arranged by the Democratic-led unions of Buenos Aires on May 1st, was a great success. I was there myself. Now, as to the reaction of organized labor, I would like to read one line from a letter sent to me by Juan Antonio Acuña, General Secretary of the Trade Union Confederation of Uruguay. The letter just arrived today. In this letter he says, Nixon has won a great battle for democracy and friendship with the United States. Now, why this responsible attitude on the part of labor? I think it is to a great extent the result of 15 years of active cooperation between unions of Latin America and the FOL-CIO and other labor organizations in North America. And since we are going to discuss later on some of the things that we may do to correct the situation, allow me to advance this bit of information. Hundreds of labor leaders have had an opportunity to visit the United States in the last few years under the Point 4 program or the United States government program of exchange person. These people have seen at first hand American democracy at work, and they are now no longer easy prey of the communist campaign of slander against our country.
Thank you, Mr. Rimualdi. We want to get back to you and talk to you more about what the AFL-CIO is doing and a little bit more about the labor situation in South America, and particularly its political aspects. The Inter-American Association for Democracy and Freedom was founded to promote democracy in Latin America. It opposes both dictatorship and communism. The association's Secretary General is Miss Frances Grant. Miss Grant, your particular vantage point would help us. How do you feel about what's been going on?
Well, of course, I agree with my colleagues and friends on this program in general. However, Dr. Burley has said, it would be very foolish for us to dismiss it only on the grounds of communist instigation. Moreover, I think we must recognize that in each country, the circumstances were different. And if you will notice, as has been said tonight, that the demonstrations became more and more acute according to the memory of the recent memory of dictatorship in Venezuela, where there is a very deep wound in dictatorship, the demonstration became more violent. And I think this has a very deep psychological significance that we ought to talk about a little later, because this cannot be oversimplified into one generality in our discussion tonight.
In other words, you can't talk about South America as a single unit.
No, nor these demonstrations, I think. I think they arise from different circumstances in each country.
Well, I'm delighted that our panel here this afternoon comes to this problem from many different points of view. And the gentleman I want to introduce now is Mr. Robert Alexander, who also has another point of view. He's professor of economics at Rutgers University. He's author of Communism in Latin America, considered to be one of the really definitive books on the subject. Mr. Alexander, could we have your observations?
I'd like to pick up from what Ms. Grant had to say.
Yes.
It seems to me that there must be a distinction made between the demonstrations in Peru and those in Venezuela. It would seem to me, at least, that it's more likely that the demonstration in Peru was a more purely communist-inspired thing than the one in Venezuela. Perhaps in Peru also there was cooperation in this with the extreme right wing in the politics of the country, which is very anxious to do anything which might create an embarrassment for the present government of Peru, which is a middle-of-the-road democratic regime. It seems to me that in Venezuela, on the contrary, there was probably a great deal more of popular support for, not necessarily for stoning our vice president, but for a demonstration against the United States policy towards their country. Because, frankly, we've had, in recent years, until the fall of Perez Jimenez, we've had a rather abominable policy towards that country, one of at least ostensibly favoring one of the worst dictatorships that Latin America's had in several decades.
Well, now, you're all apparently in agreement that this is not something that was purely communist-inspired, but you seem to leave the impression that the communists were able to capture what was generally a popular feeling. Is that generally
exactly
your feeling? Well, now, I suppose we have to ask why this sudden, if it is sudden, anti-American feeling. Mr. Plaza?
Well, I wouldn't say it's sudden. I would say that they took advantage of the circumstances. They had an outstanding official personality in Latin America, and they wanted him to know exactly how they felt. Now, going back to the communistic angle, I must say that many people in the United States are under the impression that there are very large and growing communist parties in Latin America. I don't think that is the case. A few communists who are past masters as organizers of these sort of things can take over a demonstration if the right ingredients are present. In this case, in Latin America, as a party themselves, a group of people themselves, they couldn't have organized and they couldn't have set forth their demonstrations on their own. They took advantage of existing favorable ingredients and put them to their own services, and used groups of people, particularly in the universities, young people, to express their grievances in a way that the communists know how to do.
Well, what are these grievances?
Well, I would say that the fundamental grievance, which I have stated before, is that people in Latin America think that U.S. policy toward Latin America is not and has not been adequate to meet the problems that are growing in that region of the world.
Mr. Alexander?
It seems to me that the fact of the matter is that since the death of Roosevelt, virtually, we've had no policy towards Latin America. We've had no overall objectives which we were trying to achieve in the area, which has resulted in a situation in which any pressure group in this country, which had a particular interest in a given situation, as in many cases the armed forces and giving medals to some of the dictators, for example, have been able to get their way, because there's been no overall guidelines of policy which might stand in the way of whatever pressure group was operating in any given situation.
Well, Mr. Burley, you were in the driver's seat there for a while, weren't you?
We're all experts around this table, you see, but I wonder whether we might not sum up a little on some of these things. President Gallup Plaza is everlastingly right in saying that there's nothing sudden about it. All of us who've been following this have been watching this mount for years, and some of us have said it and written it before, so that there's nothing new about this, I think, to anyone here. The second is to underscore what President Gallup Plaza calls the inadequacy of American policy. I think that since President Roosevelt's death, roughly a couple of years after, we have had no policy, and I'd like to make two points for future discussion. In the first place, at the close of 1945, all of Latin America joined in trying to induce the United States to make the equivalent of an American system. This was to be a defense system, which we do have, the Treaty of Rio Janeiro, and an economic system, which was forecast in the hope that we would bring together this region into one solid, coherent unit that would provide for everyone. That then slowly faded away. The other is that the United States has not discriminated between brutal dictatorships stealing money in large quantities, Pérez Jiménez of Venezuela being the last one to come here with a fortune reputed to be $250 million, though that may be exaggerated, at the same time that we were not so cordial or cooperative with the democratic governments. In the past few years, South America has changed from a country chiefly ruled by dictators to a continent chiefly ruled by democracies. President Gallup Plaza is one of the architects of this, and he's sitting here tonight, so he knows. Now, what has happened has been that where a government like ours backs a dictatorship like Pérez Jiménez, when that dictator is finally removed or thrown out, there is a vast accumulation of popular resentment against a government which gave their former oppressor help, or which they think gave him help.
The latter is correct, that they think gave him help.
Well, I think that is all we need to talk about here, because we could debate the facts, but certainly that is a widespread impression in Latin America.
Mr. Burley, what you say raises a question, and I'd like to give you a chance to clarify it, if you would, sir. You talk about the economic system that was planned for South America, which did not reach fruition, and you talk at the same time about our playing games with dictators. Now, isn't it a fact that if we had set up an economic system that would have worked very well in South America, we would, in fact, have reinforced the dictators?
I very much doubt that. I don't think that is necessary at all. I don't think it needs to have happened. That raises some much larger questions. It will take all night to go into it. In part, however, I think the dictatorship system was due to the fact that there was no apparent economic outlet. I am inclined to think that an arrangement could have been worked out by which it would be an economic system supporting peoples, not necessarily supporting dictatorial governments. That is my conviction, and I could give you technical reasons for it.
Miss Grant?
Well, I think Dr. Plaza has said something quite interesting. He has pointed out that actually the communist parties in Latin America are not large. They are insidious, but not large. However, our whole policy has been predicated on the ideal that our one fight in this hemisphere is against communism. And the entire defense system is predicated on the possibility of fighting an east-west war here, whereas we have another kind of dictatorship which should have been considered at the same time, because they're really two sides of the one coin, both the extreme rightist dictatorship as well as a communist.
Francis, may I take a little exception, or rather may I disagree a little from your too emphatic statement, in my opinion, that the communist parties in Latin America are most insignificant. Now, take for instance the case of Peru. Well, we know that in the southern part of Peru, in Arequipa and in Cusco, the communists are very strong.
As a matter of fact, they almost took over control.
They almost took over control. And now we know that in Venezuela, due to circumstances that is still too soon to analyze, the communists became part and parcel of the so-called patriotic junta. In other words, up to this present moment, the communists have received in Venezuela full citizenship rights. Shall we say, the political party, the communist party in Venezuela, is still a member of the Patriotic Junta, together with the other three Democratic Party that repudiated the demonstration of the other day. This is a tremendous mistake on my part. And so in Argentina, I was in Argentina when a wreath was laid by each political party at the monument of San Martin, and after we listened to the names of the Radical Party, the Conservative Party, the Democratic Party, the Socialist Party, here comes Rodolfo Gioldi, who was received and he laid a wreath in the name of the Communist Party of Argentina. Now, they are coming up because of the weakness of some democratic parties that they don't realize that you cannot cooperate with the communists as if they were a real democratic party. On the contrary, they are the enemy of democracy. And in Venezuela, since it's only 100 days that dictatorship has been overthrown, I believe that the event of the last two or three days will result in the real opening of the eyes on the part of the other democratic groups, and they perhaps, I'm confident, that they will just separate from the communists and break any connection with them. The political atmosphere in Venezuela will then be much clearer.
Mr. Romaldi, I think Mr. Alexander wants to comment on what you've just said.
Yeah, I'd like to disagree a little bit with you, Serafino. It seems to me that in Venezuela, although the communists are part of the Junta Patriotica itself doesn't amount to anything now. And the other three parties, Democratic Action, the Christian Social Party, and the Democratic Republican Union, have more or less ostracized the communists from any consultation with them. All proclamations now are issued in the name of these three parties and without the communists. And the
good
communists
news,
were,
good
the
news.
The communists were told that they were to have no more part in this tripartite group.
Well, you were there 3 weeks ago, yeah. So you have better up-to-date information.
Well, gentlemen, I think what you've done, so far as I am concerned, and I imagine so far as our listeners is concerned, is generally to agree that this was not entirely communist-inspired and that there are policies which most of the panel apparently feels on the part of the United States have been inadequate to meet the situation. I want to ask you all what specific things we have done that are wrong. I want to ask you what we have not done that you think we should do. Well, let's look at this thing once more. Let's see if we can isolate what is the problem that faces the American people here in terms of its relationship with South America. Mr. Plaza?
I would like to say now what my opinion is of the real fundamental problem that is troubling Latin America and will grow to be quite larger and more serious in the future unless something is done about it. Since the war, Latin America grew at a very fast rate up to 10 years after the war. And we did it in spite of the fact that we were only exporters and producers of raw materials and foodstuffs. But that production, that accelerated production, at the highest prices that our commodities had ever demanded, was able to take care of the situation as it was before, but is changing rapidly now. We had a small upper class, upper economic class, that improved the standard of living. We have a new middle class that in some countries hardly existed before, and in others was a very small minority. That middle class is growing. And that middle class has improved also its standard of living, thanks to post-war prosperity. But the great underprivileged classes hardly received any benefit from post-war prosperity. But it touched them just enough to make them see that there was a better life and that they had a right to seek it. Now, in Latin America, as producers of raw materials and foodstuffs for export, we have an economic system which is a poor producer of goods and services. And no matter how we try to distribute our production, if we want to improve the lot of all the people in Latin America, it is impossible for it to go around. So our chief problem is to seek a more efficient economic system that will take care of our growing problems, not only the tremendous growth in population, Latin America is the fastest growing region in the world, but the upgrading of the standard of living of a large sector of that population is causing greater demands on this inadequate economic system. We think in Latin America that industrialization is the answer, but industrialization needs larger markets. And the only way to create larger markets would be to break down the barriers that each country has set up, converting themselves in watertight compartments, economically speaking. People in Latin America are thinking in terms of a Latin American common market that would make possible sound industrial development throughout Latin America, giving work to all the people, making possible a higher standard of living, and putting into effect an economic system that will be a more efficient producer of goods and services than the system we have today. Now, the people in Latin America, some understand clearly what the problem is. Others are not quite sure what the problem is, but if it's stated to them and explained to them, they recognize it. And they think that U.S. policy, on two points in particular, I wouldn't say does not favor this these changes in Latin America, but at least they think. I'm not saying that I believe, but they think. And that's what we're interested in now, what the people think in Latin America, that the United States is dragging its feet in helping solve some of those problems. They think that the United States has taken Latin America for granted, that we're friends, and there's no reason to bother themselves with the problems of Latin America because they're not serious problems, and we're seeing that they really are serious problems. We are simply too far down the list of priorities in the world. And furthermore, there's a standing conviction. It's almost a second nature with people in Latin America. They think that the United States would like to keep us as producers of raw materials forever and to sell us manufactured goods. And our experience over the last number of years has been that the same amount of raw materials has been able to buy less and less manufactured goods. The sooner that U.S. foreign policy is able to dispel these impressions that might not be true, there might be, I wouldn't like to commit myself on this, but it is the belief of the people. But the sooner that these impressions are dispelled by practical positive action, we will be able to get on the right path of improving our relations with Latin America.
Now, do you gentlemen agree with that basic premise, that this is the problem that South America faces?
I think that's one of them. I think that there are three problems. One is a failure of organization here. Later, I'm going to urge that we ought to have, as the second-ranking man in the State Department and Undersecretary of State for Latin America, who may have access to the president in case of necessity. That's number one. That's local here. The second is the economic problem, of which Gallup Plaza has outlined one aspect of it. I have a couple more I'd like to put in. I think that besides the Latin American common market with which we should cooperate, we ought promptly to enter into some commodity stabilization agreements so that a country like Ecuador may not live well or starve because the price of cocoa has fluctuated 50% in a single crop, which it does, or countries like Brazil, Colombia, Salvador, and Costa Rica may starve because the price of coffee goes through the floor. There are four or five such commodities which, if stabilized now, I think would produce a rapid change in the situation. These, I think, in turn, should be bracketed with a third economic problem, which is the steady assistance of manufacturing development all over the region, and in that respect to the common market, as President Gallup Plaza says, is essential. The third, I think, is a straight political problem. I think our policy should tend to favor those honest and representative governments which are working for their people, and work very solidly with those governments. And where you have a government with which you cannot work, which has happened in the past, though it is not as true today as it was a couple of years ago, there I think we should develop high people-to-people relationships, maintaining merely correct relations with the government without cordiality. That, I think, is a triple-barreled policy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, the economic problem, I think, is basic to all this. I think it is forgotten that 50% of all American trade goes either to Canada or Latin America, but a much higher degree of Latin American trade comes to the United States. And when there is a slight recession here, a major variation in price which is not serious for us, it may bankrupt an entire country. It was in 1931, 2, and 3 that credit strain here automatically bankrupted about half of South America. None of us who lived through that have forgotten it. The same thing is true when the price of copper falls or the demand falls off. Countries can't live that way. A government can't plan its budget. Nothing can happen sensibly as long as the elephant in bed with smaller animals can perhaps roll over in his sleep and squash them on the way. I hope President Gallup Plaza won't consider this an insulting metaphor, but what I mean is that we are so big economically that we without even knowing it, will inflict misery on a whole block of population in South America. They have been urging that we do something about it. It is in part, I think, the fault of some of the Latin American governments and their peoples. I might as well say so. There are two sides to this. But it is also true that we have not, since Roosevelt's attempt to meet the problem of industrialization and to talk in terms of an inter-American bank and to try to bring this thing into a system, since his day, everyone has gone down there and preached sermons on the beauty of free enterprise and balancing your budget and then gone home. It is not good enough. And the time has come, really, to plan a job.
I think
yes, Professor, Mr. Romaldi?
Professor Berley has put the finger in what, from my trade union observatory, is the basic grievance of the Latin American people. What do we hear from representative of labor? What do they write to us, so the FOL-CIO? Practically, every week we get letters requesting us to use our influence with the government to prevent, for instance, in the case of Chile, the imposition of the duty on copper, and also from the miners of Peru and Mexico and other country about lead and zinc. Just 2 weeks ago, the Inter-American Committee of the FOL-CIO entertained a request from the Colombian trade union movement to do something, to urge our government to grant loan to Colombia because the fall of price of coffee has provoked a great dislocation in the economy of that country. At every labor congress, Inter-American Labor Congress, we hear this request. We want price stabilization of our export products. It has been done in the case of sugar. Why not for coffee? Why not for other material, export raw material?
Mr. Romaldi, if I may interrupt you for just a moment, you talk about the attitude of the labor union people in South America, and yet earlier you told us that the labor union people did not participate in these demonstrations.
No.
Now, how do you account for that? Why are the students the ones?
I would say the labor people, because they have achieved a degree of maturity, and while they complain, and I'm sure that they express their views in their conversation with Vice President Nixon, and the students and the others, in my opinion, they have been neglected. There is one field in which I think very little has been done to show to the young intellectual left America what really the American way of life is. It was 2 years ago when I wrote an article for in volume 2 of Historic Mission of Violence and Deceit, published by the House Committee on American Activities on September 30, 1956. I went back today and I read again that article in which I said 2 years ago, quote, "The communist influence among intellectual circles, and particularly the student bodies of Latin America, has been one of the unpleasant realities of the last decade." Communists have really infiltrated, in my opinion, the student bodies of Latin America. We remember the demonstrations a few years ago in Panama, the demonstration in Guatemala, in Mexico City. And I think this is one of the aspects that has to be a wonderful problem that can be cured by promoting a wider, a greater exchange. Let many students from Latin America come to this country. But on the other hand, let's not forget, sir, that most of the young intellectuals in Latin America have a feeling of economic insecurity. Their economic condition is bad. They have no great future. And therefore, they are easy prey for the communist temptation. They toy with the idea that the planned economy a la communist would probably solve their problems. And therefore, every time that there is an economic grievance, such as the question of price of wool or the fall of price of copper, the lack of trade with the United States, etc., etc., the communists, who are extremely nationalistic, are lending their willing ear to the arguments of the nationalists and the communists at the same time. I think this is one thing that has to be done. The expert, I am not an expert in the intellectual field, Bob Alexander and others may have a better suggestion, but I think we should give, explain in a more effective way and probably get more people from Latin America to visit us.
Well, let's find out from Mr. Alexander if he does have the idea you're talking about.
I certainly would agree with this. It seems to me that the International Exchange of Persons program is one of the most important aspects of trying to rebuild relations between the United States and Latin America. I found, by and large, it isn't universally true, but by and large, people who come to this country from Latin America tend to go back with a more friendly attitude than when they came up. This is even true of students, I'll say. It's more true of...
Now, there's a professor talking, if I ever heard that.
it's more true of trade unionists and perhaps more mature intellectuals, but I think even students come up here very anti-Yankee and go back with a good deal more understanding of why we act the way we do sometimes and of the complexity of problems here and of the fact that we don't do some of the more horrid things which we're pictured as doing down in Latin America.
May I cut in on this? I'm an honorary professor myself of the University of Brazil, and I've lectured at a number of universities in Central and South America, and I'm one of the board that has to do with the University of Puerto Rico now. I think these men need not merely a better understanding of what we do. They need a system which they can move into themselves and operate. It's not merely a question of knowledge. These young men want to know where to go and what to do. Some of them seek communism or fascism, as the case may be, in a mad endeavor to break out of what looks like a closed circle. And you have not only to tell them what we have been able to do here, but what can be done in their own countries. And the United States ought to be able to work out in cooperation with its Latin American neighbors ways and means by which they can promptly be put into action.
Would you go a step further with that?
Go ahead, Mr.
What do you mean? What do you mean by steps to be taken that would bring about a condition in a Latin American country which would give this student an opportunity? Who's going to do that? Is the government going to do that? And which government?
There are various ways of doing it, but I can tell you one of the ways that we worked out in Brazil. That happened to be a government job because we're making the loan which set up the first steel mill in South America.
Do you think, sir, that government loans can be the complete and final answer to this?
I do not. I simply say that was the way we were working it then. But with that, we likewise worked out an arrangement by which the young students who had studied engineering either in Brazil at that time or in the United States could immediately go to work and take an apprentice's engineer's job in that plant. and thereafter go out and get jobs after having had some solid experience. This is just one little way. There are endless ways by which you do it.
Miss Grant?
I would like to interpose one thing. You brought up the question of interchange, and I think we should face here the question of our immigration and visa policy in Latin America.
Good work.
Because you cannot have some of the best professionals and intellectuals and students have wanted to come here, even not on scholarships, and have been denied admission. Now, in Venezuela, that I think constituted, in this demonstration, one of the very very weak points of, or at least one of the hurts of the demonstration, because, as I understand it, many of the demonstrators said, you have accepted Perez Jimenez but refused some of our leaders, and that is true, because many who want to come are denied the possibility of coming. And I think that's one of the re-examinations we must make as to our immigration and visa policy. Now, may I just correct Mr. Romualdi? I did not say the communists were insignificant, but insidious. You misunderstood my word.
Oh, friends, my apologies. My apologies.
Miss Grant, could I pick you up on something that you said earlier? You suggested that the demonstrations in the different countries were not to be categorized in one lump group, that they were all separate and they were all different contributing causes in the different countries. And yet when you talk about something like the United States immigration policy, this would not in itself make the difference among the demonstrations of the countries.
No,
economic policies probably would not make the difference. No. Why were they different?
Well, for instance, as Dr. Alexander has pointed out, you take Peru. Peru, there was a situation in Peru already in which the extreme left and the extreme right were demonstrating against the government to embarrass it. They used and exploited the arrival of Nixon to aggravate that situation. I don't think it was only aimed at Vice President Nixon, but also at the government itself, which is a moderate government supported by a majority of people.
Miss Grant,
yes?
I would agree with that. If I had not seen the viciousness of the approach of this group, I'll say one group, actually it was some students, older folks, and some hardcore communists. But if it were merely an opportunity to embarrass the government, that viciousness wouldn't have been there.
Well,
you don't spit in people's faces because you want to embarrass the government.
I don't condone it, but do you know the viciousness has been going on in Cusco before Vice President Nixon arrived? And down also the strikes in Cusco?
Well, I heard something about that. But
why, it's been a very bad situation. It's been quite chaotic. And therefore, the same type of viciousness has been used against the government people even before the arrival of Vice President Nixon. I think it was aggravated, and I don't condone them, but I think we must understand them. Whereas in Venezuela, the situation changed completely.
You mentioned Peru, Miss Grant, and Vice President Nixon was quoted in Peru as saying that South America will not support a free enterprise system that seems to be designed to protect the few. And this, in effect, is what you have said here this evening.
The
system of distribution is what's at fault.
Is
isn't this something?
I think you all did.
Yes.
But isn't this a problem that has to be settled by the countries involved? And how is the United States involved in this?
Well, we
suffer the ill effects, but what can we do?
I think we have been in error in trying to sell the Latin Americans on free enterprise at all costs. And that was one thing which I wanted to bring up, that it seems to me that in addition to a price stabilization program for their principal export products, it's very imperative that we have a very sizable loan and grant program for Latin America, to aid in economic development. And we cannot insist, as particularly I'm afraid this administration has done, that the burden of economic development in Latin America must be by private enterprise, because private enterprise cannot do and is not interested in doing the kind of job that needs being done.
I was hoping, Mr. Alexander, that we could look at these problems on a sort of non-political basis. And
I think you've talked
about this administration, and as a matter of record, I think we have to indicate that the loans and grants are voted by the Congress, which happens to be a Democratic Congress.
Except that the Export-Import Bank loans, for example, are not. They're the general funds are granted by them, but what
is given specifically depends on...
Well, if we'll take the curse off, I'm nationally a Democrat and everybody knows it, but I think that both parties have made the same mistake.
I think
this has been going on for at least 10 years, long before the present administration
well,
got in.
Now that we've made our footnote to history, let's go on with the basic problem. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
On the question,
yes, Mr. Romaldi.
On the question of loans, we hear a lot of complaints. Actually, we have given a lot of money. But still, the people of Latin America persist in their belief that we are opposed to giving loans to state monopolies because we are committed to the support of free enterprise. Now, I don't think that it's correct.
That's not wholly true. We supported the
true.
Chilean Compañía de Fomento,
yes,
which is one of the most successful things.
Somehow, we always come with 1159 train. We allow these people to go on with this propaganda, and then in the end we wound up by giving money, and I know we are giving a lot of money. This gives me an opportunity to say from my point of view that we should not be stampeded in any hasty action in one direction or the other. It would be a disaster for our prestige and standing in Latin America if we should suddenly now, as a result of this very deplorable incident, and I use the incident because I deliberately want to understate their importance, if we should immediately rush and say to the Latino, from now on we'll not be guilty anymore here. We give you everything you want. That would be a better approach. On the other end, the worst approach would be to retaliate. I was glad to hear today from the President and the Vice President that firm statement that our friendship with the Latin American people remains unimpaired, remains the same. And I think we should work along this same lines. But we discussed a little before, if I might take another minute or so.
Yeah, surely.
The political approach. The Latinos are Latinos, and they give tremendous importance to what they call the psychological effect of many of our actions. We have said time and time again that within the limitation of diplomatic propriety, we should not treat the dictatorship the same way we treat the democratic regime. Therefore, why give medals to the dictators? And we have given medals to everyone, particularly Perez Quimera. Now, I was shocked, like all others.
I'm sorry, sir. We gave the medal to the state. He merely he got it because he was happened to be the man that was running it. That medal was given to the state, not to the man.
Well, the people in Venezuela
are wrong.
As a medal to Perez Jimenez for his contribution to the cause of democracy.
That's right.
And the same medal was given to Odria. And I tell you, Mr. Church, that I'm sure that many people in responsible position of our government were not very happy over that action. Now, why this viciousness? I think it is our duty to try to understand, to try to see the causes. Now, I have no words to deplore what happened, the viciousness of this thing. But why it happened in Venezuela? First of all, because it's only 100 days that the dictatorship was overthrown. Why the newspapers don't point out that for over 1 year the University of Caracas was closed and hundreds of students were in jail, tortured. Innumerable cases of torture and persecution at the hands of the secret police under Chief Pedro Estrada. Naturally, after the dictatorship was overthrown, they find out that Pedro Estrada was given a visa to come to the United States. I hope you, Mr. Church, have some good news about this matter of the visa. But worse than that, the former U.S. ambassador to Caracas, now ambassador in Cairo, a week after the suppression of the first large-scale popular revolt against the Perez Jimenez dictatorship, which happened on New Year's Day, he sent a letter of congratulation on the stationery of the Foreign Service to the chief of police, Pedro Estrada. And this the photostatic copies of this letter was published in the front page of the Communist Daily newspapers. I say this in order to try to understand how easy it was for the communists to take advantage of the emotional climate which had permeated the student body of Venezuela and lead them to these savage acts that we all deplore and I hope will be the beginning of a new era in our relationship with Latin America.
I agree entirely with what you have to say, Serafino, and I'd just like to take advantage of this possible last chance of saying something. Time is very short. I'd like to first clarify the record on one point. The question was asked, which wasn't answered. Doesn't the economic development of Latin America rest chiefly with Latin Americans themselves and not with the United States?
Mr. Plaza, I asked that question, and you, as the former president of Ecuador, I think are in an admirable position to answer it.
Well, I'll gladly answer it. I'll try to answer it. Of course, Latin Americans are responsible for their future, and the main effort should rest with them. But in order to develop their countries, they need a consistent, overall, long-term policy from the United States. Our economies depend so much on the United States that anything that happens in the United States, any change in the United States policies, affects us in a very serious way. And no development is possible unless they can depend on a consistent policy from the United States.
May I add a footnote?
Can you hold just a second, Miss Church?
Yes.
Will you hold just a moment?
Yes.
I just want to say two more words. I think that after this very interesting talk this evening, we all agree on one thing, that something is radically wrong in U.S.-Latin America relations, and something should be done. Whatever is done should be positive, should be dynamic, and should be imaginative.
And continuous.
And yeah. Continuous.
You mentioned the word consistent, and you seem to emphasize that, Mr. Plaza.
I do, because U.S. foreign policy, especially in economic matters, has changed, making impossible any continuous planning in Latin America.
Mr. Alexander?
I'd just like to say one word on something which hasn't been brought up very much tonight, and that is the fact that I think all too much we've tended to look at Latin America in military terms, in the necessity for continental defense and so on, which has brought us to give armaments to a number of the armies in Latin America, which are not good for very much else except maintaining dictatorships. The classic example is the one we've talked most about tonight, Venezuela, where we gave provided a great deal of arms for the Pérez Jiménez government, but the army disappeared overnight once, and the Air Force particularly disappeared overnight once the uprising began early in January.
Well, supplementing that, you know, the democracies of Latin America have helped it a great burden to be in the armament situation. As Gonzalo Facio, the ambassador of Costa Rica, pointed out in the Organization of American States in proposing a disarmament program for Latin America. Now, I did want to point out Bolivia as the country that we have helped in solving its exactly the problem you brought out, the problem of the money, the distribution of resources for the many instead of the few.
The one thing that we don't have to worry about distribution of is problems, and we seem to have them in South America. Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to Radio Beat, bringing you tonight a special discussion of United States relations with Latin America. Participating in this exchange were Gallo Plaza, former president of Ecuador, Adolf A. Burley, Jr., former assistant secretary of state, Serafino Romualdi, inter-American representative of the AFL-CIO, Robert Alexander, associate professor of economics at Rutgers University and author of Communism in Latin America, Francis Grant, Secretary General of the Inter-American Association for Democracy and Freedom, and Wells Church of CBS News. Our moderator was CBS News correspondent Stuart Novins. This edition of Radio Beat was produced by Jay McMullen and was a Unit 1 presentation of CBS News.